Well, friends, you can keep your Bible open there in Mark chapter 15, and here we are, basically. After quite some time, we've finally arrived at the big stuff, the climax, you might say. Everything in the Gospel of Mark has been moving toward this moment. Jesus himself has had his eyes fixed on this moment, anticipating this event as he heads toward Jerusalem. This is the moment where we see Jesus mocked and crucified. It's the moment where we see our Jesus actually wear that crown of thorns. And it's all been building towards this moment. But I tell you, as you look at the details in this passage, they're not easy to stomach, really, are they? And if you've spent time this week looking at these things and reflecting on them, or if you just tuned in right then when we were reading this passage, it can be quite hard to actually handle the details. It can be the case, though, that you grow a bit numb over the years if you've read these passages many times before. However, if you slow down and you take some time to take this stuff in and you actually give it time and you picture it, you'll begin to feel it. And if you let it get to you, you'll find yourself potentially quite disturbed again by the gory details of what happens here. Unless, of course, you're one of those people that kind of thrives on blood and gore, then chances are you'll find this quite unbearable to really consider. It is a bit like a horror show. My eldest son this week wanted to watch that TV series AD, Empire and Kingdom, and the first show in that series is got a fair bit of graphic detail about Jesus's mocking and particularly his crucifixion. Now he really wanted to watch it, and so we talked about it for a bit, and then I thought, okay, I'm warning you, it's one thing to read about it, but when you sit down, you kind of watch a video graphic, you know, depiction of it, it's another thing. And so anyway, even with the warning, he was pretty determined he wanted to see it. And so we sat down and we watched it. And it gets heavy, doesn't it? You actually kind of see Jesus and you hear him cry and you see the blood and it's see him getting nailed to the cross. And, you know, in that moment, tears began to flow. And we needed to press stop, because it all gets too much. We needed to stop and just spend some time processing and thinking. And maybe you're someone who you're like, no, I never want to actually watch a video depiction of that. And that's fine, maybe even a little bit wise. But even if you never want to watch a depiction of it, we've got the details, the gory details here in the scriptures that we are to read and we are to spend time reflecting on. And it can be a little exhausting going over the details. It can be hard. But here it is, the gory details. And if it's here, then we need to trust that it's for us and we need to take the time to consider it. We need to believe it's here for a reason. And I would suggest one of the reasons is we're meant to feel it. More so, we're meant to understand it. We're meant to get the big picture of all the gory details here. So how do we understand it? Well, I want to share with you tonight four things that help me handle the horror of these moments. Four things that help me handle the horror. And I hope that'll be helpful for you as well. Here's the first one. Romans be Romans. All right? And by that, what I mean is, as you look at the details of what's happening here, a lot of it can be explained by considering that this is just Roman soldiers doing what Roman soldiers do. Now, understanding this actually probably won't take away the hurt and the pain of considering the detail, but it will help you understand the context, and that's important for us. So Romans be Romans is our first one. The Roman Empire was one of the most powerful empires ever in history. And at this point in time, when Jesus walked the earth, the Roman Empire ruled a huge proportion of civilization. And one of the ways that they maintained control of the masses and was to actually display their power, and particularly in regards to their treatment to any condemned criminals or rebels against the Roman Empire. In fact, they'd actually turned public executions into somewhat of an art form, because what they did with many of their public executions was turn it into a form of entertainment for everyone to come and watch. The Romans would have fun, and they'd play games, and they invented sports around the execution of criminals. What they would do is they'd do that in order to publicly humiliate a criminal against the state, and in doing that, actually send a very clear message of warning to anyone else who was considering a crime, and particularly crime of rebelling against the Roman Empire, to get the message out, here's how it's going to go for you if you attempt to defy us. You know, it was a very effective way of instilling fear in the masses to not rebel against your oppressor, your controller here, Rome. And so the Romans invented many kind of cruel games to play, murderous games to play with convicted criminals. You'd be familiar with scenes, you know, in the Colosseum, you know, because we've seen movies like Gladiator, or maybe some of you have seen movies like Gladiator. Maybe you've been to Rome and maybe you've visited those kind of maybe you visited the Colosseum and, you know, looked in awe at these wonderful structures. And it's one thing to admire the Colosseum or what's left of it. It's another thing to remember what it was built for originally, at least. And what it originally was built for basically was to turn mass executions into a form of entertainment. That's what it's for. And so unarmed criminals would be thrown into the ring to fight against gladiators who had weapons, and they'd just get slaughtered, and everyone would cheer and applaud. Or criminals would be thrown in to actually try to see how long they could survive against wild beasts who would actually just tear them apart. Christians actually used to be dressed up with lambskins on them and thrown in among the lions, and everyone would clap and cheer as people are torn apart. They made up all other kinds of games, you know, not simply in the Colosseum, but they would dress up criminals in costumes and move them around on these huge game boards as game pieces. They just kept inventing ways to have fun with convicted criminals for their own entertainment and to actually instill fear in the masses. And when you understand that, that helps you understand what they're doing with Jesus here. Because check it out. Here they see Jesus convicted of treason, claiming to be a king, and there's no other king in Rome apart from Caesar. The minute Jesus gets convicted and condemned to death, you can almost see the Roman soldiers rubbing their hands together and thinking, this is good, let's have some fun with this guy. Yeah? He thinks he's the king. Let's enact a coronation of the king. That's what they're doing. They're enacting this kind of fake mock coronation ceremony where they take Jesus and they take him into the palace. Can you see that detail at the beginning of our reading? Verse 16. It was likely the royal palace, probably where Pilate lived at the time. They take him into the palace and they go there with the whole company of soldiers, you see in the rest of the verse, which could have been hundreds, maybe up to 500 or 600 soldiers. So can you picture that for a minute? Hundreds of Roman soldiers surrounding Jesus, and they dress him up. They put a royal purple robe on him so he looks like a king. And they want to put a crown on him, but crowns are hard to find, and so they go and make one. And they go out and find a thorn bush, and they go to lengths, and it would have taken some time to do this, and they fabricate this crown of thorns, and no doubt that would have been difficult and even painful for the people who were doing it. And then they ram it upon his head. They put his crown on. It's premeditated. It would have taken time. They're enjoying themselves. And then they all start paying sarcastic homage to this king, who they don't think is really the king. They hail before him, they bow down before him, but then they also spit on him and strike him with sticks and clubs, and beat him up good and proper. This is just Roman soldiers doing what Roman soldiers did for entertainment. And then they take him out and crucify him. And again, You know, crucifixion actually existed before the Roman Empire came to power, but the Romans actually turned it into, they loved crucifixion as a form of execution. And so they kind of popularized it. You know, estimates say that the Romans actually crucified tens of thousands of people in their time in power. And they preferred that method of execution because you could publicly humiliate a person because you strip them of their clothes and you put them up in front of everyone to walk past. And it acts as a visual warning for anyone who walks past. And you try and do it particularly when during times of festivals, like when the Passover is happening and there's a lot of visitors coming into town. Perfect time to string them up. And execution, crucifixion is good because the men would usually last for days hanging there on the cross, and so the message would last for quite some time. They often would mix wine with myrrh, which was just a pain-numbing, kind of senses-dulling kind of thing to drink, and that was good because that would just prolong the drama because the men would last longer. They would often divide up the clothes of the people who they're crucifying because the clothes would be stripped off them, and the soldiers would usually attempt to get some of the clothing as just as a memento or as a trophy, because of having fun here. And they put a notice above those who get crucified so that anyone walks past can see why this person's being crucified. And so Jesus gets the notice that simply says, King of the Jews. And it's written in three different languages, so no one can miss the message. You want to claim to be king in the Roman Empire, this is what's going to happen to you. So people can walk past, look at what this criminal has done. They can shake their heads in disgust, and then walk on and feel the message of warning. Now, my point in making all those points is to simply say this. A lot of the details here in this passage can be explained by understanding that this is Romans doing what Romans did. It's them flexing their muscles, kind of trying to control the masses by instilling fear, by making sport of public execution of criminals. Now, that doesn't really help hugely to handle all the horror, doesn't it? It doesn't make it go away, but it does give you a bit more understanding as you get a bit of context, yeah? So there's the first one. The second thing that helps me handle the horror here is this. The details that we're looking at here, as horrific as they are, show God to be trustworthy. It's the second one. And you might think, how can horrific details show God to be trustworthy? Well, here's the deal. Many of these details are actually fulfilling prophecy made hundreds, even 1,000 years earlier about how the Messiah, the King, would come and suffer. And many of these details are actually the fulfilling of that prophecy. Now, Psalm 22, the passage that we just had read before, is one of the places where you can go to see a whole heap of prophecy and promises about details about what would happen for the Messiah when he comes. And we are directed to go to Psalm 22 by Jesus himself, by the way, which is a song that David wrote. We're directed there by Jesus because when Jesus is hanging there on the cross, he cries out a number of things, but one of the things he cries out is, my God, why have you forsaken me? Which is a cry of distress, at least. But it's also a direction to Psalm 22 because he's crying out here the first line of the song. So it's almost like as Jesus cries out that in the moment, no one actually got it. Jesus cried out there in that moment so that we would get it actually, so that we would go to Psalm 22 and see all the details of what was happening to Jesus and see that it's not just a coincidence and it's not just a mistake. This has all been promised in advance. Our God is trustworthy. When he says something's going to happen, that's exactly what happened. So come back to Psalm 22 with me and look at some of the details here. Graham read them to us. And as we read some of these verses, I want you to picture what you've just heard about Jesus in his mocking and crucifying. We'll pick it up there in verse 12. Picture Jesus surrounded by hundreds of Roman soldiers mocking him and beating him up. And then read verse 12. Many bulls surround me, strong bulls from Bashan encircle me. Roaring lions, they tear their prey, open their mouths wide against me. I'm poured out like water. All my bones are out of joint. My heart is turned to wax. It's melted within me. My mouth is dried up like potsherd, and my tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You lay me in the dust of death. Is that not a helpful description of what it's like for Jesus to be surrounded and beaten up and to be at the point of death before he even goes to crucifixion? And he's no doubt dehydrated. All that detail's there. Can you see that? This is 1,000 years before Jesus goes to the cross. But then you read on. Now picture Jesus, what actually happens for Jesus as he's hung there on the cross and some of the details that happened. And read verse 16. Dogs surround me. A pack of villains encircle me. They pierce my hands and my feet. There's crucifixion. All my bones are on display. People stare and gloat over me. There's Jesus, stripped of his clothes. Everyone can see all of him. Verse 18, they divide my clothes among them and cast lots for my garment. Friends, this detail has been promised 1,000 years before this even happens. God goes, no, here's what's going to happen. And he does it through this Song of David. And then while Jesus is hanging there on the cross, the way that he is insulted by people who are walking past, come back to verse 6, 6, 7 and 8. But I'm a worm and not a man, scorned by everyone, despised by the people. All who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads. That's literally what it says in Mark. People walk past, hurling insults, shaking their heads. He trusts in the Lord, they say. Let the Lord rescue him. Let him deliver him, since he delights in him. Even these words, the subject matter of the mocking, is exactly what Jesus gets there on the cross. You think you're so powerful, mate? You think you've saved others? You know, why don't you get yourself off the cross? Why doesn't your God rescue him? This is all this detail is prophesied early. And it's not just Psalm 22. Geez, you can go to Psalm 31 and see the detail about the wine and the myrrh. You can go to the classic Isaiah 52, 53 and see all the details about the suffering servant there. So much of the detail of what happens for Jesus here is prophesied in advance so that we would see this is not just a tragic mistake. So that we would see when God says something's going to happen, it's going to happen. Many of these gory details show us that God is trustworthy. And if he says something's going to happen, it's going to happen. You can trust him today. You can trust his word. Because if he says something's going to happen, it's going to happen. If he says to us, you come to me, you put your trust in me, you can receive salvation now and you can be secure for that final day, you can trust him. You can trust him. It helps me handle the horror. When I see that a lot of the gory details here are just prophesied in advance, shows me that God is trustworthy. Here's the third one. The third thing that helps me to handle the horror is knowing that what happened here secured our salvation. You know, the horror of what's going on here is actually our salvation being secured. And particularly as Jesus hangs on the cross. And as he hangs on the cross, he actually dies a relatively short death. You know, guys would hang there for days. Jesus hangs there for 6 hours before he dies, which is still horrific. It's 6 hours of no pain relief. It's 6 hours of struggling to breathe. It's 6 hours of appearing to be defeated. But we know that actually something huge was being achieved. Yeah? Jesus was bearing our sin. Jesus was bearing the wrath of God for our sin so that we could be forgiven and we could be saved. The innocent one was being condemned so that the guilty ones can go free. This is amazing. Now, there's a whole bunch of indicators. When you look at the gospel records, a whole bunch of indicators that there's something big going down. That what happens when Jesus is on the cross is so much more than just another condemned criminal going to his death. The indicators are everywhere. You see the indicator when Jesus prays in the garden and he talks about the cup, which tells us that while he's on the cross, he's drinking the cup. It's the cup of God's wrath. He's bearing God's anger in his body for us as he hangs there on the cross. Other indicators, darkness comes over the land for 3 hours, which would have been super spooky in the middle of the day. The darkness is an indication of God's judgment that's come. The cry, where Jesus says, you know, I'm forsaken, tells us that this is not just physical pain he's going through. There's something big going on between him and the Father. The earthquake, the ground shakes. The temple curtain gets torn in two. Jesus cries out, it's finished. There's so many indicators that tell us something huge was going down here on the cross. And we know what it is. We know that our salvation was being secured in the horror of that moment. This, friends, is the most spiritually significant moment in history. This helps me handle the horror. As hard as it is to face, I'm so glad that Jesus went through this. I'm so glad he didn't come down from the cross. Like everyone was insulting him and taunting him to do. Many of the calls were, you think you've saved others. Why don't you save yourself? You know, you think you're the king. If you're the king, surely you're powerful. And if you're powerful, why are you letting this happen to you? Come down off the cross, show us you really are the king, and then we'll believe. Now, they're not going to, because he does later rise from the dead, and they don't believe. But this is all the accusations that are getting thrown at Jesus. And they kind of make sense. You know, if he really is the king, and he really can save, surely he could save himself. And yes, as Jackie pointed out when we were singing, he absolutely could have saved himself. So Matthew chapter 26, Jesus says, I could call on 12 legions of angels to come to my aid. And what do you reckon 12 legions of angels could do in a moment like that? Could absolutely get him off the cross. Could absolutely obliterate any of his enemies and sort that out completely. Jesus could have called on that. He could have smashed the whole scene up. So why did he let it happen? Well, he chose to stay and die and not save himself in order to save others. So as I look and I see the suffering that's going on here, I see my God willing and determined to save sinners like me. I see my salvation in motion. And that helps me handle the horror, because it's horrific, but it's wonderful. I'm so glad I've got a God who saves, because I need to be saved. The fourth thing that helps me handle the horror of these details is this, that despite the gory of all these details, Jesus still reigns. He's still the king in that moment and after it. Jesus' kingship is not affected by what happens here in this moment. His position as the powerful, sovereign ruler of the earth is still well and truly intact, even though this happens to him. It may not look like it. You know, at first read, this doesn't look anything like a king in control. But you just dig a little bit. It actually may look a little bit more like a king being overpowered and toppled from his throne. But just dig a little bit and you'll see very quickly, make no mistake, this is actually all going according to plan. What we have here is a king who deliberately endures suffering because he's a different kind of king from any other kind of king you've known. We're talking here about the servant king, a king who lays down his life in order to save his people. And this servant king, he's the real king. He's the King of Kings. That's who he is. And this is him in action. So even as you see him being mocked and you see him being crucified, don't think for a minute that Jesus was surprised by what was going on or even intimidated by these events. Our God is not knocked around or rocked by human opposition. Our God is not left feeling insecure by our human defiance of him. He grieves it, absolutely. God grieves our state, our brokenness, for sure. But he doesn't whimper and he doesn't crumble because of humanity's hard-hearted stupidity. Our God has installed his king, and his king's name is Jesus, and he will remain. Psalm 2 helps us see how God responds and reacts to human opposition towards him. So you're already in Psalm 22 probably. Just flick back a few pages and come back to Psalm 2. We touched on this last week, the second psalm. And what you see here is, you know, one of the classic songs where, you know, worldwide human rebellion is kind of featured. How does God go when he sees that his world that he's created is actually so opposed to him, and shaking their puny little fist at him and trying to rise up against him and throw him off? You know, verses 1 to 3 describes all that. Why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot? The kings of the earth rise up and the rulers band together against the Lord and his anointed one. Friends, the details of what we're looking at this week with Jesus' mocking and crucifixion is actually the climax of the world's opposition towards God and his anointed one. They want to throw off their chains and throw off their shackles. Now, what does that do for God? Does it knock him around? Does it impact him as king? Does he find himself intimidated? Does he get sad and go and sit in a corner? Well, you tell me. Look at verse 4. The one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them, and he rebukes them in his anger, and he terrifies them in his wrath. Now, when it says God laughs and scoffs, he's not laughing and scoffing because he's enjoying what's happening in any way. And particularly when he actually pours out his anger, he's not enjoying what's happening for people in any way. He's laughing and really kind of scoffing at the stupidity of human rebellion. He's like, this is so dumb that you would rebel from me. Your attempts to defy me, they're just futile. It's silliness to the extreme. Now, why is that the case? It's because God has put his king on the throne, and his king's name is Jesus, and Jesus' position installed as the king of the earth is secure. He's secure there in that position, which means that Jesus is the one with ultimate authority, and he plans to exercise his authority. He will have the final say as the Lord of the earth. And as the psalm goes on down to the end, it ends up encouraging us a particular way to respond to the king who has been installed and will be installed for all eternity. How do you respond to a king like that? Well, you stop rising up against him, that's for sure. You, verse 12, you kiss the Son. The Son meaning the Son of God, the God's king on earth. You kiss the Son. And when you kiss the king, the way you come before the king and kiss him is you bow before him. Usually people would bow down and they would kiss the king's hand or his ring. And as they did that, that would be a sign of submission and surrender before the rule of the king. You'd give up your rebellion and your stupidity of trying to rebel against him, and you'd bow before him. That's how you respond to the king. You serve him. You rejoice and celebrate his rule. You do it with trembling and reverence, but you bow before him. You give up on your rebellion. You take refuge in him, like it says. Now, considering that reality, I can't help but to picture the soldiers as they surround Jesus with their fake coronation ceremony. Oh, the soldiers bringing Jesus into the palace, dressing him up, ramming that crown on his head, paying sarcastic homage to him, hail king, and bowing down. How tragically ironic. Yeah? Their actions and words spoke louder than they ever knew. Because contrary to their view, Jesus truly was the king of the Jews. And not just the king of the Jews, but the king of all the nations, the Lord of lords, the one who rules and reigns sovereign over all people. That's who he is. And this helps me handle the horror. Because when I see the details here, I think despite the horror of the execution, Jesus remains the King of Kings. He's not impacted or weakened in his kingship in this. He remains the Lord of Lords. So yes, he suffers, but then in power, he rises again from the dead, showing that he is the Lord of life. And he ascends back into heaven. And he's seated at the right hand of God the Father Almighty. And he will return to judge the living and the dead. Jesus still reigns, even though he allowed himself to go through that. It shows us that he's a different kind of king, yeah? He's a servant king who willingly, deliberately laid down his life and allowed himself to be humiliated and crucified so that we could be saved. He's the King who will reign for all eternity. He's the Lord of Lords. He's the one we bow before with our lives. He's the one we celebrate, even in the horror of these details. He's the King. Let me pray. Father, it is hard for us to see what happened to your Son. We can only imagine what it was like for you to see your Son journey through this kind of treatment. But Lord, we're helped. We're helped to understand and handle the horror of this by knowing that it's partly what the Roman soldiers did in that time. But more so, this is the details here of fulfilling prophecy showing you to be trustworthy. The horror of this moment is securing our salvation. And even in the midst of this moment, Jesus is still King and he still reigns. Lord, we acknowledge that tonight. We want to acknowledge that with our lives. We want to live in reverence before Jesus, our King. We want to live trembling, serving, rejoicing, because he is our King. Lord, we long for more people to turn and bow the knee to him before it's too late. Please use us to that end more than anything. You glorify your name, Lord, please. Amen.